Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling starstruck.
No.
Yes, because our guest today is an icon to me. Because I have spent the last kind of few months binge watching both of her series of her show, which is the title of what I just said, Starstruck. Mm. And if you haven't seen it yet, it's on iPlayer and probably in other like streaming platforms, but it's really worth watching because I think it's just extraordinarily well written, so funny, so heartfelt, and so much empathy and kind of strange situations all of us have ended up in. Do you know what I mean? And you can really see yourself in the show. I just love it.
I can see myself in the show. It's so weird.
I wonder why that could be. The second season, that's right, everyone, has a co-star. Well, not a co-star. What are you? You're a guest star, sorry. Yeah. A guest star of Russell Tovey. Mm. Anyway, it's such a brilliant, brilliant show. And our guest was originally fetid. Is that a word?
Sounds sexual.
It sounds, you know what I mean, celebrated for a stand-up show called Horn Dog, which also sounds a bit sexual because Horn Dog, and won the Edinburgh Festival Prize and basically fell into many people's hearts because of her humour. And laughs. Hearts and laughs. Anyway, I think I need to stop doing this intro and quickly get on to the guest that we have today. We would like to welcome to Talk Art, Rose Matafeo.
Hello. Oh my gosh, what an introduction. It was very hard to say quiet. That was fantastic. You should have seen me. I was just looking down at my nails. I'm like, this is, who are you talking about? This is horrific. And I think it should be fated, isn't it? Fated.
It just sounded right. Fated. I don't know. Fated, but it sounds.
Fate. Village fate.
Yeah, Village of Fate. Yeah, okay, sure. Fated.
Is it a Village Fate?
I don't really
know.
Yeah,
you are a Village Fate.
A Village Fate, oh my God!
So the funniest thing happened. I've been a fan of yours for a long time, and then I kept saying to Russell, I love her show, and then you asked him to be in the show, yeah. And then I was like, we have to get her on Talk Art, and then the first time I meet you was in the queue for the toilets,
I didn't know
what to do. I was like, do I hug you?
Neither do I. I will hug after this.
We'll hug after.
I came in going, I didn't do that well. I just didn't do that well. Like, I feel like I was like a bumbling professor in that moment.
It was so awkward. It's like being in a toilet queue, like in a tiny indoor hall during COVID. It's a bit like, what are you meant to do, Russ?
I think it was fine. But so maybe your fandom of the show helped get Russell to do the show, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. I kept doing hearts on all your posts.
Yeah.
And was like, I actually like reposted, what do you call them, stories on Instagram. Was like, Rose Matafeo is an icon. I love Rose Matafeo. Because I just decided that was fact.
That's so sweet.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I can't believe you watched the show. That's very sweet.
Well, congratulations on the show. I mean, it's been life-changing for you, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, yeah. It's a weird, that's a quite a strange like word, but it actually really has. Yeah. It's taken up so much of the last kind of 2 years of my life. It was kind of from Horn Dog, the show, which is, can I say, yeah, it is quite sexual. It's supposed to sound quite sexual. The actual show is anything but, really. It's about how I'm actively not sexual. Particularly in my teen years. Right. But I was doing that like in 2018. And that was when I won the Comedy Award. And then it was straight into Starstruck stuff. So it's been like a crazy roller coaster of, I don't know, just people. It's very strange to get recognized for that as well. I was just in Liverpool and I got recognized by this bunch of over 60s men who were drinking together after a football game in a tiny pub in Liverpool. And they're like, you look like that the one off TV. And I was like, who? And she's like, Rose McAfee. And I was like, that is me. And they're like, oh my God. And I was like, wow, how am I hitting this demographic? This is incredible.
That's BBC though.
I know, that is the BBC. Yeah. And I think it's the cheeky thing about the show, because I think it reaches a lot more people than, it's so heavily pitched as like this rom-com, but so many different kinds of people have watched it. Like, and you know, not just, it's a BBC Three show, which is, you know, usually skewed to the youngins.
Mm.
But then, like, it's, yeah, I know, it's just opened up a whole cool audience, you know?
So for those who haven't seen it, you are obviously the star of the show. And you
I'm
also,
not allowed to say that.
You also, well, I'm saying.
yeah.
But also, you wrote it. So yeah. What's it like? Because for me, watching it just feels real. Like, it just feels like that is real life. I am watching reality because it's that good.
But
when you actually sit down at the page, have you always been comfortable writing? Is that, like, something that you...
I love writing. Yeah. I've always loved writing when I was... a kid, like creative writing, like English, all of that. Like, I came up through like a sketch comedy show when I was in New Zealand, when I was like first starting out in comedy in my early 20s. So I learned a lot about writing with that. But this is the first like scripted narrative show that I've ever done. And it is a particular, it is an interesting thing. Like, as you say, like, you know, I play a person who's a New Zealander in their late 20s living in London. Wow, what a stretch for me. But like, you know, like obviously, you know, I'm no Daniel Day-Lewis, you know, like I draw a lot from my own experience, I think, you know, living in London and the experiences I've had here. And also when you come from stand-up, you're talking about, you know, so much of your own experiences and then trying to sort of abstract it a little bit to, you know, not reveal everything about your personal life. But I mean, the premise of the show, which is me, you know, having a one night stand with a movie star, is unfortunately the only untrue, you know, one of the untrue things. Things that are not
yet.
It is aspirational. It's not autobiographical. It is aspirational. Write what you want to see. It is weird. There are times where I write something into a script and people go, oh my gosh, who would do that? And I'm like, oh, that's happened to me. I have done that. I have read a pregnancy test wrong. I have totally probably asked someone while we're having sex if they want to have sex. You know, like this is, it's all good, true stuff. And also sometimes now things happen to me or I get myself into situations because I sometimes feel like, oh, this would be good for it.
Oh, yeah.
Which is bad. I know it's so bad, isn't it? But I feel like some writers do that, like, or actor. Like, do you find that as an actor?
Well, I think there's always a part of you that, you know, especially if it's trauma, there's a percentage of your brain that goes, remember this feeling.
Yes.
And that's kind of sociopathic.
It is sociopathic,
but
isn't it?
But as performers, that's what we do. And at times, I remember reading a story about some actor who... His wife had got run over outside, and he saw her get run over outside in the street. And as he was running down the stairs, there was a mirror in the hall, and he checked himself in the mirror and went, remember what this face is, and then carried on doing it. So he was able to objectively remove himself from his own personal trauma to hold on to an experience that he could then later recall, which is totally fucked up.
That's scary, isn't
scary,
it?
Scary, but that's what we do. I mean, I've not done anything that extreme. And
you
I'm
have,
sure
actually.
You,
you have, because he once asked me all about my brother's death. I got really emotional with him. And then the next night, I find out he's doing a reading, and he cries during the reading. And it was something about someone dying or something. It was like a live thing. And I was like...
No, I wasn't.
Russell needs to pay you.
He does.
For your trauma.
For my trauma, it's overdue.
Absolutely.
I'm calling your agent. I know her email and everything.
No, completely. No, you need some royalties from that.
This is why I love you, Rose. Yeah.
But I understand that. I understand what you're saying. Simon Amstel's got this thing in his stand-up a couple of years ago, how he was in Paris and they said, let's all run to the Arc de Triomphe. And he was running down there and he went to himself, I didn't want to be doing this, but I thought, what a great memory to create.
Yeah.
So why don't I just do
totally.
This? And you're not even in the moment. You're just like, okay, well, I can tell this story about the time that I ran in Paris.
100%. Yeah, it's a very strange thing of experiencing your life in real time, but also... retrospectively as
It's
like you're in two different timelines. It's very strange. I find some things that happen to me, I kind of go, I write it down because I go, what, like, almost like, what if that had happened differently? Like, there's something that hits upon something and I go, oh, I wish I'd done that, or I wish that had happened, and then it sparks off something and then it ends up in a script. And so it's a yeah, it's probably a bad, like, you know, cathartic kind of thing to do, to rewrite history. And
or it sounds like you want to write Sliding Doors too.
Oh my god, you should be Sliding Doors.
The next one.
Oh my god, honestly, I rewatched that recently. I've seen that movie way too many times. Actually, it's
I watched it recently as well.
Yeah, what's up? What's up with that?
I don't know, but it brought back a memory of me bumping into Gwyneth Paltrow backstage at Wembley Stadium when she just started dating Chris Martin from Coldplay, and I knocked her over and she fell over.
Oh my god!
No, no, by mistake.
I walked in.
No, I've got a full story
here. That's so horrible.
I walked into a room, she fell over, and guess who picks her up and sort of told me off?
Alan Rickman.
Oh my god.
Pretty major moment.
He told you off?
No, he wasn't telling me off, but he was a bit sort of like, it's a bit scary if someone falls. You know what I mean? It wasn't deliberate, obviously. Oh my god, maybe I shouldn't have told this story.
No, it's staying in.
Goop is coming out.
What I mean is, I burst into a room essentially backstage and was like, oh, hi, I've arrived. Because I was at OTT at that point.
Yeah.
I was about 22 or something. And and then she fell over, and then he was a bit sort of like protective, like, oh, what's going on? Because he didn't know what happened.
How easily is Gwyneth Paltrow knocked over? That's what I'm wondering. I'm like, she's got to get
a weeble. She goes down and just bounces back up.
Anyway, I love Gwyneth Paltrow. Just to let everyone know, I think she's major.
Yeah, that's great.
Not enough to not knock her over.
No. Okay, let's keep moving on.
All right, so New Zealand.
Yes.
Born and bred. Let's get on to the art.
Thank you.
So growing up in New Zealand, what was your first experiences of art?
First experiences of art were possible. Well, both my parents are incredibly artistic people. My dad went to art school until he had to drop out because my mum got pregnant. He had to get a job. He's got like a treasure trove of illustrations and art some of which I have never seen. Like he's an incredibly talented artist. But then, yes,
what do you mean? Have you never seen it?
I've only seen bits, but he's a very secretive man. There's so much I don't know about my own dad. I mean, I've obviously know him, but he's a mysterious figure. So I actually don't know a lot of his art. I come from his side of the family, though, incredibly talented artists. But yeah, he was very political as well, like in his like late teens, early 20s and stuff. So, both my parents met in, this is like a huge, both of my parents are Rastafarian. So we were part of a denomination of Rastafarianism, which is called 12 Tribes of Israel, which is the one that came to New Zealand. So there was a lot of reggae growing up. There was a lot of, I'd say weed a lot growing up at church and stuff. And also there's a lot of art.
Weed at church?
Well, it's Rastafari. I mean, it's not at church, like not at the kind of the boring, but it's actually so, like, you know, it's like religion is boring no matter how cool the religion is, right?
right,
as a kid anyway. So it's like a 3-hour meeting of like long, you know, it's actually very boring. But there was definitely, that about. But heaps of art as well, because my parents, my mum was on the art committee of our sort of, you know, church thing. And so a lot of the artworks around were like of, you know, the Emperor of Ethiopia and Haile Selassie and Marcus Garvey and all of that. So that was my early intro to art.
But in the house.
In the house, yeah. And also my mum is a huge fan of art. Like she's very, very, she kind of inundated us with art in that sense. We didn't have, we grew up in a very, very small house, very, very cluttered house. But art was a free thing to be able to go to galleries and to experience. And so she, a very funny thing actually, there was an initiative in New Zealand called, it was a Muka Art Prince basically. This couple would get lots of famous New Zealand artists to do a run of prints of their work. And it was just for kids, so 18 and under, only kids could go into this exhibition and choose a print. Each print would be $50 New Zealand and $100 if you wanted to get it framed. So it was really cheap, really affordable way to get prints that are worth way more now. No parents are allowed in, no adults are allowed in it. And I did this since I was 5 years old. So I've got from the ages of 5 to 18 prints by a collection of prints by these New Zealand artists that were only chosen by me. Like, you know, your parents couldn't tell you what to get.
Incredible, isn't it?
Isn't it amazing?
Incredible.
I've never been anything like
that. I know, I've still got heaps of the prints. I've brought them up to the London, like Dick Frizzell is a New Zealand artist, heaps of his work, Nigel Brown. And it was, yeah, it was a way that you like built these, you built up a affordable art collection from five years old. And it's really amazing because you I can track what I chose every year. So like the work I chose when I was five, I love because it was, I still love it. And I can remember picking it. And I can remember.
What does it look like?
It's this really simplistic kind of like almost like drawing of this man at the top of a building with like the aeroplane. It honestly does look like he's about to jump off a building.
And, fly.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a, but my mum was so funny and so cheeky because she'd always go, okay, you go on and buy one for yourself. All right. And you buy one for mum. She always would make me buy one, like pick one that she thinks, I would think that she would like. So then she would get one on the side. But it was honestly the coolest thing ever that my mum encouraged us, or you know, got us to do. Because
how many kids would do that?
Tons, yeah. It was like a weekend thing. And,
absolutely,
yeah,
love this.
It's such a cool idea, and I think it would be an amazing idea for people to do more often because it was. And it was super strict, you know, like, you know, you're just not allowed, like only kids. And it'll be amazing. It was an amazing experience as a child to walk into this room with all of these other children. You know, how rarely does that happen in a gallery where it's just kids just looking at this art and having to pick
one? Oh my God, this is incredible. Would someone be there with you going, what would you like? Would you go, I want this one?
There would be probably attendance, yeah, but you just have to write down the code on the thing. But there were no adults like going, oh, look at this, look at this. Like it was just, you just have to wander around and go, oh, I like that one.
Is it still
so
going?
Cool. I hope so. I wonder. I should look that up actually.
We should find out because I'd love to talk to them.
Oh my gosh. M-U-K-A, yeah.
You're actually the youngest collector we've ever had on the show. 5 years old.
I know, 5 years old.
Literally collecting art since you were 5 years old.
So
you win the prize.
And also the artist name would always be hidden as well. So you never could see who the artist was to be like, oh, I've heard of that artist before. But I would learn to like, I'd go, oh, that's a Nigel Brown. Oh, that's like a, you know, like I could.
You trained your eye from that age.
My mother did, to be honest. She was like, now Nigel Brown's work looks like a bit like this. It's got words in it. I was like, okay. I was like, she was like a little, I was like.
She's the art advisor.
I know, yeah. I know. It was pretty epic.
I'm really in awe of this.
I am
incredible.
Too.
Cool.
I wasn't even expecting this.
So outside of doing that every year, did it spark a collecting bug in you?
It did. Well, like for art, well, you know, it's so funny because as an adult, collecting art, I've never even thought of doing it because sometimes I feel like, okay, it's a, in terms of financially, I'm like, oh, I can't afford that, which is, I realized that's so untrue. I spend all my money on absolute shit. I could totally collect art. But it's fun because I moved to this country, you know, 6 or 7 years ago, and I already had this like weird collection of art to bring up with me to put on my walls. But not so much now. It's the stuff I collect is, strangely, I collect more of like, I'm very much a DIY kind of zine kind of vibe kind of person. And so I collect a lot of prints from illustrators though. Like, I love illustrators and like people I find like online I do collect, I mean, I know it's not art, but you know, like.
Well, it is art though.
Zines,
But what kind of ones? Like, are there zines that you...
Zines and comics. Just love? Random ones. Like, you'd go to craft fairs or zine fairs and then just anything, or like at random bookshops or like... Also, I'm really a fan of, I do a lot of craft. And so
You're a crocheter.
I'm a crocheter. I am
a crocheter.
We're so excited about this.
So, I love textile art and stuff. And so I try to do that. I did actually do a piece of a comedian's art exhibition a couple of years ago where I did a embroidery thing because I was like, I'm not going to draw or paint shit.
I saw that. It's
something
called Never Ending Dread in 2019 and it's a circular text work.
Yeah, I really enjoy it. That was fabric I brought up all the way from New Zealand that my mum had recently exchanged to cushions actually. And I thought that was a very funny phrase. And and then it took a long time to embroider that, but I really enjoyed that. But I was really into you know, comics as growing up as well. And so yeah, it's a lot of you know, local comic book artists in New Zealand as well, and just really into that, yeah, that style.
I just need to go back to your dad's art,
yeah,
because I haven't finished that.
Yeah.
So did you have his art up in the house?
No. So we didn't. So we had, my uncle was an artist, is an artist as well, Mark, who he would do massive, he would do more like, because I'm Samoan, he would do more like tapa, which is tapa cloth, is like a type of Samoan kind of art form.
Right.
What
is it like?
It's like kind of painted like cloth, but the cloth is like beaten, I think like sort of bark, very thin bark. So it's kind of and a lot of, you'd recognize the kind of Pacifica patterns, like, you know, I'm doing it, podcast listeners, you will not know what I'm
like
doing.
Shapes,
you know,
like
shapes my fingers, yeah. You know, all that stuff. But so he would do a lot of Pacifica inspired art and stuff. He'd made me a painting when I was born. I should show you that picture, actually. It's me as naked, as a naked little baby on this piece that my uncle hand painted for me. My dad, though, I think he was the couple of things I remember seeing, because he's got it all just hidden away, were like very like probably like of the time 80s, like illustrated, almost cartoon kind of vibes. Like, because it was a time, like, he was part of the Polynesian Panthers, which was like a political protest group in the 80s that was like big with the Springbok tour as well in the 80s, like to protesting apartheid and all of that. So I think there was a bunch of amazing sort of activist art, yeah, and stuff that he was like, you know.
But if you asked him to look at it,
yeah, he's that mysterious. It's like pulling it's very, I get nuggets of stuff from my dad, but he's a very tight seal. Yeah. He just didn't think I would be interested in a bunch of it, but I am. But
your mum's seen it, obviously.
I think so, yeah. I mean, honestly, I think he just doesn't, he's not the kind of guy like many, I mean, I don't think like many artists are, though. They're just a bit like, oh, no, that's nothing. You know, like, I don't, no big deal. But no, he's incredibly talented, but I haven't seen much of it. But I hope to unearth that. I'm going back to New Zealand at the end of the year, and I think he's ready to open up, show off.
Oh my God, he has to. You should try and do like an exhibition of his work.
I should actually. Yeah.
That'd be so cool. Like the treasure trove.
I know.
Like finding it all.
John Matafeo.
But what about yourself? So how come you're into crocheting? Is that something that you just naturally sort of gravitated towards, or is it?
Being a nerd. I being quite a bit of a nana. I've got a big nana vibe, to be honest, with my pastimes. I learned how to sew. You should see my flat. It's terrible.
Oh,
it's
grandma.
Doilies, you like a doily?
I love a doily. I love a. I mean, I've got a electric fireplace that I can turn on, and it's fans silk flames. That's my vibe. I'm massively into it. It's very off-putting to anyone who comes over. But I grew up with like a grandmother who taught her, you know, my mum to sew. My mum taught me to sew when I was really young. So I knew I was always into that kind of thing, and then taught myself how to crochet. I don't know. I think I've always just enjoyed making stuff. I love making stuff. I love doing things with my hands in that way. I've never been great at, I like drawing a bit. I've never been great at painting or anything like that, because I don't know about you guys, I tend to like hate something that I'm not immediately like show any talent in. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
You're like, oh shit, okay, no, I've got nothing. I can't do this, so I'm not going to persist. But I pushed through with crochet. I got a crochet injury, a recurring one in my left shoulder.
Well, like a repetitive strain crochet injury.
Yeah. I held the yarn too taut, and I went to a physio, and they laughed their ass off at the fact that it was crochet. Crochet! Jumper. All right,
crochet
right.
Injury,
jeez,
alert.
I really hurt myself. But yeah, I don't know. I think, and I also, I think I'm really attracted to like textiles, like in art that I like a lot of, you know, feminist art as well. Of like, I mean, the idea that, I mean, the constant idea that, you know, like that is a, is craft over art. Like, you know, I mean, like the tradition of quilting. Like quilting is just it's just an absolutely wild form of art.
Yeah,
yes.
I love it.
But it's just
it's
so
a huge,
you know,
moment, isn't it?
It
suddenly
is
being seen as fine art.
Totally
over like women's work (parenthesis) and craft.
100%. Yeah. It's because the amount of work and effort goes into it. There's an amazing quilt, actually. If you've been to the Museum of the Home, in Bethnal Green, it's this piece of this artwork, which
Museum
is
of Childhood, is it Museum of the Home.
No, Museum of the Home. I think it's written quite close by.
Okay.
It's by an overground station.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It's love that identifier.
And just help the listeners get there.
So and, go to any overground station.
Yeah, go to any overground station
in East London somewhere.
There might be the Museum of Modern nearby.
Yeah. Alston or something.
But it was like this. It was a life size floor plan of a prison cell, and all this intricate design of like all of the things that the actual size of this prison cell would be. It's up on the wall. It's fantastic. You should go check it out if you're around there. But yeah, I love all of that stuff, and I think
there's a lot of artists that work in that. Like I think of Annie Albers or Louise Bourgeois or Tracy Emin, for example, who have really brought the blanket into being something important with a message on and fine art. Yeah.
And also, we recently in Margate had a show of American artists, and it had the G's Bend quilts.
Yes.
Which Alison Jack's gallery has been showing in London, and they were obviously ignored for quite a long time, but also a bit exploited at times, I think, but now are getting into museum collections and being really respected and getting the money directly to them, which is great.
Mm-hmm. What about dioramas? That's the thing that you've been exploring.
I have been exploring that. I did a landscape artist of the year show recently, and I made a diorama for that. And after that, I was like, why did I make a diorama? This is so stupid.
It was a Whitstable.
Yeah, it was so funny where the judges were just going, it's so sweet. And I'm like, yes, it is very sweet. Made of toilet paper and matchsticks. I love dioramas. I've made a diorama, of a small scene from Rear Window, the Alfred Hitchcock film, which is on my wall at the moment. But I moved, and so it's all banged up. So it's all kind of falling apart, which I actually kind of like. But I've left it like that because it's all in disarray now. All of the furniture is upended and stuff. I was inspired by that because there was a woman who made an entire model of that, the film set of that film.
Wow.
Which is incredible. I love models. I love tiny models.
How many dioramas have you made?
three or four. I've made another one which is like a small scene, which is it's an example of like Pepper's Ghost, which is like, you know, Pepper's Ghost, it's sort of a it's a technique where you put, again, podcast listeners are going to love this because I'm doing something with my hands. A small scene, you put a pane of glass at a 45-degree angle of a scene, and then if you put a figure on one side of it and a scene on the other, and you light the figure that you're trying to make look like, it's almost like a ghost appear into the scene. So it's how they do all of the stuff in Disneyland with the Haunted Mansion, where there's like figures and you can see reflection. And like they do it a lot in lots of galleries as well. But it's kind of like an illusion that they used to use in like vaudeville times as well. But yeah, it's something to do, like the light reflects then onto the pane. It looks like, so I made a small scale model of that because I was just interested in Pepper's Ghost.
Is this Pepper as in Peppa Pig or Pepper
as in pepper, salt and pepper.
Salt and pepper, right.
Yeah.
Have you noticed that all your dioramas seem to have like a horror kind of thriller? Is your next project going to be like a murder horror?
A thriller,
I think so. I hope so.
Agatha Christie.
It could be good.
Granny.
Have you heard of that? Have you heard of those models that woman made that were all murder scenes, and they were to help the police figure out, investigate murders. Yeah, reenact.
Right.
Basically,
it had
a lot of little clues in it. It's in some sort of gallery in America. She was this woman who just sees these intricate murder scenes, and for police to go and look and learn how to examine a crime scene.
Right.
It's very cool. There's a good YouTube video on it. But no, they're all horror scenes because I did start diorama making within lockdown. And I think I was losing my actual mind. Like, the Pepper's Ghost one was a joy to make, and then I was doing the Rear Window one, and honestly, I was like just in my bedroom, in the middle of the winter lockdown with matchsticks super glued to my fingers and just going, what am I doing? What am I doing with my life? I'm making a tiny model when no one has asked me to do this. No one, not even God, not even in a Joan of Arc way. Not even God has spoken to me and said, you must make this.
No,
I wasn't summoned at all. I wasn't paid to do it. If anything, it cost me money when I could have been doing something else and I could be making money. That one wasn't so relaxing.
But hang on a minute. Let's analyze this. Let's be on the therapist's couch.
Jesus,
but like,
please.
What is it about you that wants to create? Is it the same with writing and performing and all the things you do.
Are you doing another Starstruck as well? Are you writing another one?
I'm not sure. Yeah, yeah, Russell Strutter.
Like, he wants to come back.
He's
like not being paid, and then he's like, oh, okay.
My agent just wants to know. You know.
I've got the agent's email, so I can help with that one.
I'm not so sure yet. I'm just trying to figure out if there is a story there. But I mean, I think in terms of creating stuff, yes, I think it sounds so like I just like to make things, create things. It sounds a bit like, you know, hippy dippy. But I really think it is a burden in the sense of, like, it's not necessarily good stuff. It's just I have an impulse to make stuff. It might be crap. It might be good. It's sort of the driving force of why I do anything. I'm a very lazy person, apart from when it comes to, you know, me going, oh, I want to do this thing. I want to make this thing. I want to create this. I'm going to do it. I'm so lazy in every other aspect of my life. But it's genuinely one of the only things that kind of brings me sense of, like, yeah, fulfillment and joy. Like, I like the fact that, you know, writing Starstruck is such a, you know, it's work. I get paid for it, which is fantastic. But I put as much effort into that as I do making a small scale diorama of you know, an Alfred Hitchcock scene. Because, yeah, my brain works like that.
There must be a calmness in it.
I was going to say that.
Yeah.
You must switch off and have that focus.
I think so. I think so. Just learning new skills and doing things in my hand. Like, I've just learned how to I've gotten a 60mm this Bolex camera. I've learned how to shoot on black and white 16mm and hand process all of the film. So, like,
you got a dark room.
I've got a cupboard. Right. I have a cupboard. I have a cupboard, and thankfully
a very dark cupboard.
Very dark cupboard. Thankfully, I only need that for when I'm winding sort of film onto a spool that you put into then something called a Lomo tank, which is then that's what you process it in. It's not really like you normal, you know, processing where you have to be in a dark room the entire time. You just have to be basically in a pitch black room to wind, to do something, yeah, basically with your eyes closed, to wind on a spool of film into a tank and then process it that way. But it's so funny because I never went to art school or anything, but I feel like I've learned so much stuff from the people I've encountered through doing comedy, like, you know, doing Starstruck. I learned all of that stuff from Will, who is the DP. He taught me all of that. He encouraged, like, he just taught me how to use a camera, how to develop it, all stuff that he learned when he was at art school. And I love the.
It feels like you're a complete, you know, nerd.
It feels like, yeah. Is that not obvious? No, it's not completely obvious.
I was going to be nicer than that. I was going to say it sounds like you're really curious.
That would have been so much, yeah. Well,
enthusiastic.
Been a nice,
no, no,
enthusiastic.
Nerd.
Curious.
You're a curious
a nerd.
Enthusiastic.
You were a head girl when you was at school.
I know, yeah.
Were
that,
you?
Was that a cool thing, or was
did you
that
get
like
a,
nerd? A nerdy
did you have
thing?
Like,
oh,
a,
yeah, should I
have with
it?
Like a coat of arms?
Sure. Yeah. Head girl, yeah, of course.
She's got it on today.
Yeah, listeners, I hope you can hear the clank of the ding ding.
I actually, when I got COVID, found my Blue Peter badges.
What is a Blue Peter badge?
It's a bit like being
a
girl.
It's like a Blue Peter badge, but it's kids TV.
Oh, really?
Kids TV, and you write in and you have to do tasks and then they give you a badge. And I kept writing so many times that I got two. I got the silver one and a normal one.
Oh, they just wanted to get rid of you.
For all those listeners who are jealous.
That's so sweet.
So we have film processing.
Yes.
We have embroidery. Mm-hmm. We have dioramas.
Yeah.
We have crochet and crochet injuries. Jeez. What other work?
I sound like the most eccentric Betty old
woman. Sounds like you need to write a book about
Jesus Christ. No, yeah, I've got that. I've got I've got plans. I really want to make a zine this summer, to be honest.
Great.
Because I used to make them for Starstruck, actually, every week. I'd make a weekly newsletter for the crew and cast. It was so wild. The first series of Starstruck, we did 6-day shooting weeks. And on my one day off, I would spend making hand drawing a newsletter for everyone with little bits and jokes and stuff. The fact that you now call me a nerd, I'm like, oh, it's so gutting being an adult nerd. It's such a hard life.
Oh, it's
not.
It's the best thing.
You. That's why you're here.
When we come out as geeks, you go like, this is what I like, then you shed the shame.
Russell forced me to come out as a geek.
Really?
Yeah, it was like enforced.
He was dunking
by doing talk
up. Yeah,
he was like, we're going public with this.
Yes. Yeah, totally.
It's good. No, I think that there is something nice about getting older and like out of your self-conscious 20s of going, you know, like, this idea of what's cool and what's not. It's just like, Jesus, life is too short as to not just enjoy the interests that you have. And I don't know. It's a lack of self-consciousness sometimes now I have with, you know, spending most of my money at a craft shop, which is an absolute ripoff in Stone Newington. The prices are too high.
So what do you feel like when you get into the craft shop? Is it like full of materials that you're like lusting?
Being in a stationery or craft shop is the amount of pens that I moved from New Zealand to the UK, the amount of craft paper I moved and origami. I've got origami paper that is older than some of my longest friendships. Like it's, I'm organized
so
hoarder.
Pipe cleaners. How do they make you feel?
I love a pipe cleaner. I love it. And a googly eye. Pipe cleaner and googly eye.
Oh my God.
Heaven. Like absolute heaven. I've got every ribbon you want. I've got every type of tape you want. I've got, I just collect all that stuff because I just, you know,
highlighter pens. What you like with them?
I love a highlighter pen. Yeah. Oh, I've got a good couple of highlighters on the go, actually.
Oh, yeah.
I always often have a highlighter on.
Do you highlight all your lines?
I do actually. I only do my name though because I can't be bothered using up all my good highlighter. You know.
Like, oh yeah, you don't want to drain the ink.
Don't want to drain the ink or anything.
Much more sustainable.
of course.
Going back to your origami.
Oh yeah.
So are you an origami specialist?
No, but not particularly. I can only make the fortune teller and the box, but.
What's the fortune teller?
What's the fortune teller in the box?
Oh, when you go dad, cool. And you say that rhyme.
Oh my God.
Yeah. What's the rhyme?
I usually do it. It's like a colour, and then it's like the number of letters in the colour's name.
Oh, R-E-D.
Yeah,
and then it's
numbers inside, and then you write a little fortune. Oh, you got it.
I wish we were doing this live on air, but we can't, because
I guess
it's
going to
take
after.
Too much time. I would love to do this.
Yeah, I might do that.
I forgot about those. I used to be obsessed with them.
They're really cool. And also, you could write, it was a really good, it was a really interesting opportunity to like do some like high scale bullying as a kid, you know, write some scathing fortunes and that, like, some of them would be really awful. They'd be like, you're ugly, and you're like, oh my God,
you're gonna be bald or something.
It's terrible stuff. But no, origami paper I like because I do paper craft that, like, I got into like the stop motion animation app as well a couple years ago, where I started doing sort of stop motion stuff with lots of craft paper and photos and stuff. I love physical. I'm a bit of an analog person when it comes to those things. Like, I am so bad at, I'm probably so bad at, like, you know, being able to edit together something or, like, you know,
same.
You know, yeah, doing
Photoshop
doing
and all that. No,
I can't do that at all. Mm. And I'm so proud of all my friends who can do that stuff. But but I love the toils of, like, you know, of a painstakingly doing a stop motion animation that ends up being 3 seconds long.
you spend a week on it. Yeah.
You're like, oh my God. But I love and respect people who do that, man. It's just the best. So
comedy, would you say in some ways is performance art?
Interesting. You know what? No, okay. I don't think so. I really don't. I think that it's so interesting because I feel comedy is a sphere or like a sort of area of creativity that I think connects with so many other people who do, you know, musicians, you know, writers, artists. Strangely, I mean, comedy and acting, I feel like, is the one people bunch them together, but I feel like they're actually quite different. I feel like comedians and musicians really vibe a lot in the sense that, like, I think comedians are, well, the great comedians are total space cadets. Do you know what I mean? Like, they're people who, I honestly think comedians are just artists who lack self-esteem, if that makes sense. Because I think comedy is like something that is, the intention of comedy is like, my friend Johnny White, who's like a comedian and a poet, he said something on this video recently, which I really thought was funny. Like, all jokes are questions and answers. And I think I think art is like always about asking a question, but not necessarily knowing the answer or telling you the answer. Comedy is intrinsically, you have to answer the question. There has to be a punchline to the question, which is the joke. Mm. And I think comedy, particularly stand up and stuff, is your audience, the immediate reaction of what it is so intrinsically kind of tied into the art form of it. Mm. And then I think art, what I imagine, like, you know, a lot of art, what I imagine art to be, doesn't necessarily have to take that into account. You know what I mean? I think comedy is so much, it is people pleasing.
Well, comedy needs words, and I guess art in some ways is when words aren't enough.
Yeah, exactly. And
it's,
I think,
replacing words.
Totally.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Yeah. And it's like, it's a very... I don't know, someone's very specific expression of an idea, and then it's open to interpretation, whereas comedy is about words, and it's about turning something, turning an observation to something that a lot of people can immediately understand. Yeah. And I think it's that kind of, and I think both of those things are like rooted in the same thing, which is an expression of an idea, but the way in which it's expressed is so different.
Mm.
I think performance art is intense and often a lot less funny than comedy.
Sometimes it is.
I mean, sometimes performance art is so surreal and abstract that you're like, what the heck? Like, do I laugh? Have you ever laughed? Have you ever laughed? Be honest, at a performance art piece, or you found, or you, or like a, you've
well,
been
it's
in
uncomfortable
a situation.
Laugh like this. Yeah. Is, someone's making a weird noise. I went to a performance once where Christian Marclay has this comic strip which goes on and on and on and on. The White Cube Gallery, they had a performance where they brought one actor in and he read this scroll of, and basically it's noises like zip, zap, wham, bang, zzz, like that.
Yeah.
And I took my mum along. Yeah. I thought, you like this, mum? And we sat down, this guy started, and he's like, zip. My mum went, what the bloody hell is this? And we were there for like 45 minutes and she kept giving me side eye like, when can we go? I said, we're at the front, mum. We can't go anywhere. And this guy was like, terrifying.
Oh my God.
And I was just giggling going, this is like, just seeing it through my mum's eyes.
Exactly.
Being like, what the bloody hell have you brought me to?
That's so funny. My brother who lives in Berlin, my mum was visiting him recently as well. And he took her to this piece, this performance art piece. They thought it was a film screening. And it turned out to be more of a performance thing.
Mm.
And it was this incredible thing where the artist, like, they were speaking in German, and then he explained to my mum, he was like, oh, they're saying that they're not going to play the film until there's only 20 people here. And there were far more than 20 people there. So it was this waiting game. So they just waited. They just waited and waited. They waited for 2 hours. My brother was like, I want to try and see it. My mum had to wait for 2 hours. I think it was 2 hours to try and watch this film, and they didn't end up getting down to 20, so they didn't do it. I think that was the idea of that is so funny.
But it's also so really funny. Fascinating, like, experiment.
Yeah. Total,
in
totally amazing experiment.
And,
yeah.
Because people are like, oh, we should leave them, but they're like, no, I want to
see it. Yeah. I thought it was.
I bet they were eyeballing each other, going, "Go on, fuck off."
Exactly. It was an amazing experiment. I know. I'm sad that my. And also, it's probably better. Like,
maybe
I bet
it wasn't even a film.
Exactly. It probably didn't even live up to the expectations of what it was. But you know, I think
it'd
that
be
was
a 3 second
thing.
Stop animation, wouldn't it?
God, I'd love to do a gig like that, a stand up gig. I'm not starting until there's only 20 of you here. That'd be fantastic. Oh my God.
I remember being at Art Basel once and they recreated Marina Abramovich's nude performance from 1977 where you have a man and a woman standing in like a really tight space, like a hallway, a corridor, sorry.
Yeah.
And you've got to like walk through.
A doorway.
A doorway. Mm. And I remember just being like so embarrassed because I was like with sort of collective
friends
of mine
or something. Because you were recreating it.
You were one of them. Oh my God.
But anyway, that one was quite memorable. Because you're sort of like, do I walk through? And then how do you feel? And you're with your sort of collectors and you're trying to be all serious. And it's just, it's an amazing
awkward.
Artwork.
It is.
It's awkward. And it makes you, all your own inhibitions and whatever they're called, but like it freaks you out.
Yeah. It's great though, isn't it? It's like, it's annoyingly the point, isn't it?
Yeah, no, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, it's not meant to be easy.
Yeah.
Oh my God, yeah.
Have you met any famous artists?
I Yeah, I probably have, and I probably forgot. The one that springs to mind is so funny because I didn't realize he was who he was. It was at a dinner at my friend Alex's house, like a dinner party. And he's like, I'll come over for dinner. My friends are going to be there. And I was like, oh, cool, great. And it turned out to be Martin Creed.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Really? Yeah.
Yeah. And it was so funny because I was just like, so what do you, like, I was like, what do you do? And he didn't know what I did as well. And he was so lovely. He was so lovely. We had such a great normal chat. We were talking about the Fast and the Furious films. They were recently rewatching them and they were really loving them. And I was like, Martin Creed loves Fast and the Furious films?
Also, he was set where you were.
Yeah. We interviewed him in the early days. Yeah.
In the early seasons.
And he makes music as well. And he's definitely got a connection between music and art, which is probably linked to comedy as well, because he's really interested in like Dada and all those kind of earlier ideas of art as well.
Yeah, yeah. It was I was like, come to my show, Martin, you'll like it. But I don't think he ever showed up. But
I remember because he sounds like Billy Connolly, doesn't he?
He does, yeah.
I remember saying to him, I said, you sound like Billy Connolly. He's like, do I? No, I don't. It's like
you really never heard him,
and he looks like him.
He does.
It's like, okay,
he's got that look.
Okay, Martin.
He was terribly, terribly kind. But no, apart from that, I probably don't, you know, run in the same circles as many cool artists.
But you go to a lot of galleries outside of the home quilt.
The home quilt play. Well, I recently was in New York for the first time, like in many years. I went to my mum is obsessed with art in the sense that she's always like, go to this gallery, gotta go see this.
Scottish, isn't she?
She's from New Zealand, but she's a Scottish Croatian mix of you know, brought up in New Zealand. But she made me go to MoMA. Well, she didn't make me go to MoMA. I went to MoMA because I wanted to go to MoMA. Great, great gift store as well.
Oh, yeah,
great gift shop.
Obsessed.
Got some great slippers there. MoMA was sick. MoMA was fantastic. I saw some great stuff there. I saw this awesome piece of this artist who has, it was just all of their hair and fingernails on a shelf. And eventually when they die, their ashes are going to be on the shelf. Like there's this.
God, can I Google this?
Google this one. Yeah, because it's amazing. The hair.
So it's a living artist.
Yeah, it's a living artist. So, and then all of the hair gets increasingly grayer. And then, like, this artist went through, like, you know, has a little spiel about, you know, like, the circumstances in which they made the work. And then,
it's Adrian Piper, who I love.
Oh, yeah.
How do I not
She's
know
brilliant.
This one?
Yeah.
It's Adrian Piper. It's called What Will Become of Me.
Yes.
She makes a lot of video art.
1985.
Yes.
There was some great
video. There's one
of
her dancing on the way. I think it's called Dancing to Berlin or something.
Yeah, I love it.
Love Adrian Piper.
That was awesome. That was the one I was like, whoa, that was the one that floored me when I was there.
So does she update it regularly herself? Like you're saying the hair goes grey.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's incrementally like, and more I think it's fingernails in here. And then the last one would be ashes. I don't know if she's adding more here, but maybe she is adding
more. No, she
more
is. It says she adds it through her life. So it started in 1985.
Yes.
And she fills honey jars with hair and fingernails whenever she cuts them. So every time she cuts them, she just fills it.
So and I wonder how the process is with MoMA that she has in place, that she sort of goes into the collection. Because it isn't always on display, I wouldn't assume. And she would go into the archives and sort of just top up her nails and hair.
Yeah, I know,
and then
exactly.
Leave.
I mean, the ash thing, I'm like, that's wild.
But that's the ultimate artist kind of church, isn't it? If you're at MoMA when you die, your
ashes. Also, it sounds like deliberate because Piper declared her intention to donate this work to the MoMA because, as both an African-American and a woman, two groups that have traditionally been marginalised in the history of art, she's literally inserting herself into the museum collection.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like her body in the collection. That's amazing.
Wow.
Wow.
I've never even heard of this artwork.
No.
That is, by the way, that is why I love art.
Yes.
Because daily, Russell, somebody will tell me about a new artwork that I didn't know about.
Oh my
and it
God.
Might be, you know what I mean? It's endless.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I know barely anything about art, but it was the one bit, the one piece that I was like, geez, that's cool.
That is cool.
I really enjoyed it. But you know, the one museum I really enjoyed, which I think not many people get to, is the Museum of Folk Art in New York.
Mm.
Yes.
Oh my
Beautiful.
Gosh. I just loved it so much. There was this artist, oh my God, I forgot her name, but she was this incredible artist who did all of these basically illustrations, these of this from as when she was a teenager, in the 50s, I think, of this place called Catville. And it's all of this is hybrid kind of romance comics with people who are like cats and dogs, as well as like there was massive storylines she would draw in her school books and stuff. It was one of the coolest things I've seen, actually. And that whole museum is just so, so brilliant. Amazing quilts in that museum.
Sounds like you have an affinity for self-taught art and folk art and kind of art that sort of overlooks because it's not contemporary. It's not part of an art world discussion in some ways. But it is more now. That again, is changing. It feels like them conversations are starting to...
Totally. I have so many eccentric family members as well in my family who are artistic, but certainly don't come from the background of, you know, being trained artists, and they still find ways to express themselves. I had an Uncle Torrance, great Uncle Torrance. He would do this the most amazing sort of, it is like folk art. Like he'd do these paintings in acrylic of like, you know, scenes from the place he'd grow up, where my grandmother and him grew up, and scenes of his just, I had one piece, which was just his dog Sparky. And he did paint all of these these paintings. Like he was so prolific at them. And it was just like the coolest thing ever. It was just like, this person's doing it for no one else but themselves. And just like, just because he just wanted to. And they were so cool and so like, you know, technically. It was funny. I painted on the front of that diorama for landscape artists. I wrote like untrained eye because I was like, this is, I love something about like, you know, art that's, I mean, I love all art, but like the stories behind stuff that comes from, you know, people who didn't necessarily want it to be seen or did it for themselves or were not.
But it's just trained, a compulsion, you know, to create, which I think you have.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, we discover all your stuff and like you would find you like...
Oh my God, you'll find my creepy dioramas in the folk art museum one day. They'll be like, these were found amongst the, you know, the chicken necks and the cat and the cat shit and, you know, it'd be fantastic.
What about New Zealand? Do you have memories of galleries and kind of spaces that you went to growing up?
And like Māori art, was that a big thing?
Māori art, indigenous art. I mean, like, you know, Māori art is incredible. Like, you know, it's a massive part of this country. Also Pacifica art, you know, there's a lot of amazing artists like John Pule and stuff from New Zealand. And I think Auckland Art Gallery was probably the biggest gallery that I would go to a lot.
Mm. And you lived near there, didn't you?
I grew up in Auckland. Right. So Mum would take us to the art gallery quite a bit. She was, you know, she was very much, I think art is my mum's thing. It's the thing that makes her feel like very, like I'm more of a person where music and film and stuff do that stuff for me as well. But like she is a person who really forced art into our lives, which is cool because it was something that was, you know, affordable. Many galleries, like most galleries are free, you know, like it was a really amazing thing to grow up with as a child. New Plymouth is also a place I love in New Zealand because it's got the art gallery. I think it's called the Len Lai Museum because I love Len Lai, who does New Zealand artists, but did a lot of kinetic sculptures. It's got an amazing kinetic sculpture in New Plymouth, which is just the wind, like this wand that kind of bends on the coast with the wind. People take the piss out of it, but I really love it. And he used to do... you know, Len Lai, he used to do GPO kind of short films back in the day, and is it color box or like?
No, I've seen these recently. Weirdly.
Yeah, N or NW is one of my favorite shorts ever, and it's Len Lai, and it's
what's it called again?
N or NW.
N or N. And so North or Northwest.
Yeah, North or Northwest, but it's basically about it's for the you know, post office. Basically telling you to get your postcode right, but it's awesome. it's like a public service announcement. These PSAs that he'd make, but you know, alongside all of his mad animations and sort of experimental animations and stuff. And I really love it because I love, you know, getting into all the film stuff. And but they're really groovy and cool and very much my, you know,
aesthetic.
Analog aesthetic.
Yeah,
vibe.
I actually discovered Len Lai last summer because Dries Van Noten did a whole fashion collection for men and women, maybe based on all of the Len Lai films.
Really?
And he projected them onto fabric, and then they've got all these printed fabric. I can show you.
Oh my God, that sounds amazing.
I knew it. All like this, look, and it's all his films, but on shirts. And he made this whole entire collection based on Len Lai.
Shut up.
Yeah. And I'd never heard of them live.
Oh my God.
I don't know why, but I hadn't.
That's
and I actually
so
looked
crazy.
Into it all last summer.
Oh, it's in BC, yeah.
Yeah, and then they did these amazing projections on the catwalk and stuff with all the projections of his films like, on the bodies.
That's
it's
so cool.
Yeah, but isn't that weird?
God.
Like, I discovered Len Lai through fashion.
That's
but
so cool.
I love it when you find right, things through those different routes.
That's so fun. I'm going to look that up. Well,
yeah.
I mean...
Because he was born in Christchurch, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was born in Christchurch, and then he grew up, I think he's got... you know, links in New Plymouth and stuff. And he took a lot of inspiration, I think, from living in New Zealand and a lot of Māori and Pacific Island art and stuff. But I think his animations are so cool and fun and just like, yeah, I love them.
Do you find it weird that there's not, like, I was going through a list of New Zealand artists that I know of, and mm-hmm. there's Francis Yu Pritchard, mm-hmm. an artist called Simon Denny, who represented New Zealand at the Venice Biennale.
He was in our book as well, and talk
about
book.
But there doesn't seem to be that many New Zealand artists that
put
we know about.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I mean, like, I grew up, you always grow up kind of knowing like the classics, like, well, there's like Rita Angus and like Colin McCann, and oh God, what are the New Zealanders? There's lots, you know. Lots that I can't think of right now, Dick Frizzell or like, you know, a bunch. But then you always do forget their names. And like, it's always that art gallery tour that you have to do at school, and you're like, write your thing about them. And we'd always learn in art history. Actually, we didn't learn enough about New Zealand art history. We'd always learn about, you know, it's just always impressionism or something like that. Yeah. But no, New Zealand has got amazing artists.
Yeah.
I think amazing artists with
Tracy Moffat. She's New Zealand, isn't she?
I don't know.
I think Tracy Moffat.
I think Noel McKenna is.
I think he's Australian.
Oh, he's Australian.
How dare you?
How
very dare you?
But I just find it strange that there isn't. We don't have so many references. Yeah, like we don't know these names as much, and I wonder why that is.
I don't know as well. I mean, maybe like, is it because with art in terms of like your identity or your nationality sometimes isn't as intrinsic to the piece? Like it's not like me, or I'm not an artist, but like. You can tell I'm from New Zealand from my accent, but like with art, like even Len Lai, like I told my friend he loves Len Lai, and I was like, he's New Zealand. He's like, what? He had no idea. And I think maybe it's that because it's, I don't know, you've got a bit more anonymity in that sense, but no, it is weird that there's not, I mean, maybe it's just geography as well. We are very far away. We're very far away.
I think, people have said that before about New Zealand Australian artists. That it's a geography thing. It's like, there's not many times you pass through to go somewhere else. It is the end destination.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
if you're coming from here,
Yeah.
If you're going to Antarctica, you do have to go through New Zealand, I think. So.
Do you?
I think, you have to do, Or Australia. No, I think it's New Zealand. But we're a stopover for Antarctica, at least. But yeah, you should go, though. You should go. There's a good art scene down there.
Hang on, you were making watercolour paintings. I've just seen this down because you've missed this off the list during the pandemic.
Oh, yeah, I did my watercolour. Yeah, I did try and get into watercolour. Yeah, I
from the craft shop?
From the craft shop. Yeah, I was actually at Edinburgh. I was kind of looking to do something that was slightly relaxing and trying to take me out of the world of the Edinburgh Fringe, Festival. So I started, like, painting nudes of my friends, but not, like, of them modelling, just like what I imagined. So, and then giving it to them. They enjoyed it, actually. I did one of, I was living.
Imagined
with,
nudes of your friends.
I made Al Green, who is a comedian I was living with that year, him pose on the couch. And then I did the death of Al Green, but then I did it as a nude. And I did give it to him, but I don't think he...
And do you see all of his bits?
I think he did, yeah. But it was actually, I wasn't proficient with the watercolour, so it kind of was just a blob. So it was more...
Well, I guess it gets you away from...
Exactly. Like, exactly. It was just blob.
Isn't watercolour really hard, though? I think it's harder than people think.
Yeah, I think there was something nice, though, about it, because it is so hard that it's, like, so imperfect or, like... like you can't be really exact with it, that you kind of, it kind of is like, okay, no, fine, like it's gonna go wherever it wants to go, as opposed to like paint. I've just never been able to paint like with acrylics or like, you know, not oils at all, but like it, with that stuff I feel like it's too concrete. And I love drawing, and I love watercolor because there's something so like, you know, free to it. I love the look of watercolour, though. I did a watercolour in lockdown, but with, like, I based it on, like, this frame from, like, a romance novel comic thing that I that I read in an old magazine that obviously I buy because I'm an eccentric nerd.
when are we seeing the exhibition, The Writer's Metaphor?
Oh my God, you should do like one with your dad. It could be like your dad's work, your work.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Let's see the connection.
That's a really good idea.
It is a good idea.
I would love that.
I think I should
do a zine with your dad.
I should do a zine with my dad. Oh, that's a very good idea, to be honest. I mean, I am going to try and get him to unearth some of his work when I go and visit him at Christmas. So, and I would love to be able to, you know, I should just, you know, scan it for like, you know, posterity. But
yeah.
I think I would love to do it. That's a really good idea. I'm going to ask my dad to do something in the zine. I mean, he's also I don't know what work he'd put forward, but I think it would be very interesting. Yeah.
Maybe you can write your responses.
Yeah.
To having never seen it before. You could write like little essays. That would be so cool.
Should that be good?
Oh my God, I love this.
Idea.
I'm thinking up ideas.
This is a talk out production.
It is.
Oh my God, presented by talk out.
Oh my God.
No, he'll be stuck.
So you live with a lot of art. You live with a lot of these prints. You shipped over a lot of crepe paper and materials. Above your bed, you have a photograph of...
Above my bed, I got a photograph of Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward kissing. Which is an iconic photo, I guess, but also kind of full-on one to have above my bed, I think, because, you know, when I seldom have company, it's probably quite a very clear...
It's a lot to live up to.
It's a lot to...
It's like, are you my Paul Newman?
This is what's going to happen on this bed, okay? Shoes off, though. They got the shoes on. Let's take the shoes off. I've got that. I've got lots of prints of... I'm obsessed with, like, old Hollywood. I've got lots of prints of just dead people around my house. I just bought a... one of Ava Gardner that sits on my like my dresser and stuff. I always buy, you know what, my biggest hack when I moved here and when I, you know, when you're a bit skint is like just go to art galleries and buy postcards of art.
Yes.
When you can't afford it. My walls were covered with postcards of art that I loved. And it's the cheapest way to just bring art into your fucking like peripherals, you know, every day.
Into your orbit, yeah.
Into your orbit and like and to just enjoy it for, you know, while you have not much money. And so I've got so many postcards of you know, artworks from art galleries that I've loved. And then I'm slowly replacing them with actually framed pieces of art. Or
so nice.
Yeah. It's a cool thing.
Elton John talks about that, how he used to have framed posters and of photographs he loved and these classics.
Yeah.
And now he owns the original
really?
Photograph.
Yeah.
And it's like this kind of astral projection.
That's you, next.
Cool. Oh
that's
my God.
You, Rose.
Oh my God, that's me.
From maybe. Fridge magnet and postcard all the way
or
to the real
a poster of the exhibition. Yeah, we've always said that on Talk Art. It's like you don't need to have a budget to live with art.
Oh my God, totally not. I think it's...
You can print it off on your printer, do you know what I mean? And stick it on your fridge.
My mum did that. She would print off and laminate pieces of art that she liked. She'd always have on every... There was no empty surface in our house, no empty bit of wall space. If I showed you a picture of my house when I was growing up, I will find one to show you after. It's there was no space wasted. And I think it's so important. I mean, it depends on what kind of person you are. If you're a maximalist, you're a minimalist. If you're a minimalist, you're not the kind of person who wants to put
I'm desperate to be a minimalist.
Me too. Wouldn't it be such a dream?
I just love stuff.
Me too.
Have you ever had a really emotional response to an artwork? Like, have you ever turned to like a museum or a gallery or an artwork at a moment of sadness or, do you know what I mean? Like some sort of emotional connection.
It's interesting. I feel like not particularly in the sense I feel like it affects other people. And so my mum, again, like she'd just be like, go and see this Jackson Pollock painting. I'm like, yeah, I will. I'll enjoy that. And I enjoy it, but it's never the same. Like you can't tell someone to react in a way, you know what I mean? Like, enjoy that. That I had a reaction to, because I think you're expected to have a reaction to so much, is when I saw, so like Rothko in I think Wellington. Like
that's one of the artists that you're told to have a reaction. You're gonna get this reaction.
Exactly.
You wait for it.
You wait for it, and then sometimes it doesn't come, and you're like, it really doesn't come. And then
then you're like, what's wrong with me?
Exactly.
Like I can't access it. I've had that feeling with it.
Totally. And I think there were some pieces in that where I was like, oh, I feel something here. But I hate being told what to do in that sense. I think I saw No, there was one piece that I felt an unexpected. I think the context of also when I'm looking at always affects it. Like, you know, often it's times it's you're alone in a foreign city and you project something onto some poor girl in a Degas painting or something. And you're like, that girl is me. And so you can have a reaction like that. But I do have reactions to Ed, like, strangely, like Hopper paintings, you know, like I think the
loneliness.
There is, yeah, the abject loneliness of a Hopper painting I just love, because it's like, I'm like trying to figure out, you're like, how is he orchestrated an immediate reaction here, or like an immediate storyline? Like I can I was actually looking at because there's a film, Pennies from Heaven, the Steve Martin film, which is kind of a remake of Singing Detective in the 80s and stuff. And they actually based a lot of the frames on Hopper artworks and stuff. And I was going and, you know, as a nerd does, you know, comparing the two and stuff. The ones that, yeah, but the what's the one with the usherette? The Hopper one. I really love that one. And that always makes me, because I used to be
your dioramas, like Nighthawks.
Yeah.
That exactly. is like your dioramas.
Well, the diorama, that specific one for the Hitchcock one, is the one of the Miss Lonely Hearts, which is the woman in Rear Window who is like having dinner with no one. And it's the most poetic of all of the apartments, I think. And it's really fun to like have no figures in it as well. But yeah, I think lonely artworks I do vibe with a lot, because not that I'm lonely or anything.
I was thinking the other day the other day about how artworks can be like friends, like just one on one. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Like I've got
you're inviting these things into your home.
Yeah,
they're a guest, aren't they? You
know, seeing them every day. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Completely. No, I feel like I've got way too many, again, like pictures of dead movie stars around my house, where I start to think, you know, oh, there's Ingrid Bergman in here. It's Cary Grant. Okay, great. Hi,
morning,
Cary.
Ingrid.
Good morning, Ingrid. Good morning, Cary.
Do they have to be dead? Or?
They don't have to be dead, but it's preferable. No, it just seems like that all of the ones I enjoy are, unfortunately, dead.
You've got an old soul.
Yeah, I do. I have an old soul. And it's old soul, and my body is quickly catching up. So, you know, I'll be just an old soul in an old body. So, yeah.
Well, we're going to move on to our last questions.
Okay.
I'm just so obsessed with you. The first question we ask every guest is, if you could do an imaginary art heist and you could have any work of art for yourself from anywhere in the world, it can be anything. It can be a film.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a car.
Or
it can
building.
Be a building or anything.
Help you. We'll bring you trucks and helicopters and anything you need.
What would it be and why?
It could be like Agatha Christie's glasses.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. An art heist. Like a piece of something.
Yeah. Yes. Something that's meaningful for you.
Holy crap, that's a really difficult question.
I mean, the Adrian Piper's a nice thing, but you wouldn't want that. I don't think you'd want to live with her nails and hair.
I wouldn't want to live with that nails.
And you'd be
and
taking
hair.
Her out of MoMA,
which is breaking the artwork. Yeah,
this is true. One funny thing, one relic of pop culture that I recently tried to actually buy, I would like to heist because I wish I'd bought it. I went to a jewelry auction at Bonhams for an entire day to try and buy Joan Collins's engagement ring from 1964, 1963, that Anthony Newley bought for her. And I'm kind of obsessed with him, even though he's a terrible guy. But
is he dead?
He's dead, don't worry.
Okay.
He's dead. Yeah, he's dead. He can be on the wall. I went there the entire day. I had a budget. It went over that. Someone bought it. And I want to hunt it down. It was a beautiful.
You had pushed yourself further?
I wish, yes, but then I think I would have had a nervous breakdown had I spent the money.
How much did it sell for?
I think it was 16, but then I read later maybe it was 20. But I think the Warren Beatty ring got 20. We went for 20, and this one went for 16.
Sometimes they add VAT and tax and stuff.
Oh yeah,
and these royalties or whatever on top, and then it ends up being so.
Would
much.
You have worn it?
I think I would have worn it, but
really?
I think I would have worn it I think it is also a cursed ring.
Oh.
Because they had, you know, such a tumultuous relationship, but it's a relic that I'm sort of obsessed
with. You're still thinking about.
And are you a fan of Joan then as well?
I'm a fan of Joan, yes, definitely, but I'm a fan of their relationship. I love her. I love him. I love their weird scenario. I'm a massive film buff, not film nerd. I don't know much about film, but I'm a film nerd. So it would be some sort of pop culture, you know, shit.
Were you aware of this ring before the sale come up?
Yeah, my friend, Emma, my friend, she read about it in Who magazine. She read about it. She texted me. She went, "Babe, this Alan Joan Collins is ring. This Alan Joan Collins is, you got to get down there." She was like, "You got to get down there." I've never been to an auction in my life. Never.
What? How did you find it? I mean, it's quiet. I get really exhilarated. And then I always feel like when they throw the gavel down and you hadn't won, it's like, you loser.
It's
horrible. Yeah, horrible.
My heart,
like
my
you're being punished.
Not getting it. I didn't even get to bid because I was too nervous. Like, I could have bid because the bid started at, you know, a price at which I was like, okay, I could spend that much. But then it got so fast and online bidders were there and all this stuff.
I hate online bidders.
It was an online bidder who won and I was just like, oh, come on, man. It was just so excruciating.
Be in the room and do
You're
it.
Not even in the room.
I know, right?
How dare you?
But you had your little paddle and everything.
I had a paddle. I had a paddle and everything. I went there exclusively to just see, you know, I should have gone and I think they did viewings of all of the rings. Mm. I should have done that before the day before and just checked it out. Also, I have fat fingers, so I never would have fit it. I would have to have worn it on my pinky, which would have been
quite
weird.
Well, no, you could have put it on a chain and had it around your neck.
But then I was stressed out because
then
I'm like, then I have to insure this ring? I need to know where the ring is. And it was also this thing of like, I have, you know, I'm really lucky to be working, you know, have an income, but I've gone from, you know, doing comedy where it's like, you're pretty skint a lot of the time to then like, so then your brain is a bit like, I'm still a reduced sticker at Tesco person where I'm like, oh, that's a bargain. Or I'm like, I'm not paying that much for a train ticket. Then I'm going, wait, so you're also considering buying a diamond ring from Joe Collins? And I couldn't compute, I couldn't rectify, you know, like those two personalities. Yeah. Like,
so what would happen if you met her though, and you were like wearing her ring?
I think she wouldn't mind. She wouldn't
I get that,
it.
Though, because it's a gift to yourself. You would be able to put all of your kind of achievements thus far into this object that you then acquire. Yeah. I get that. So you're able to even though you don't want to spend that on a taxi or that meal's too expensive or that bottle of wine, but this object suddenly becomes something for life. It's not frivolous.
Like a talisman.
Yeah, totally. A talisman.
Oh, I hope you find another talisman. What would it be?
Oh, God. I'm not sure. I mean, I think it is probably something that some, you know, random celebrity that I liked from way back in the day has owned. I remember when I was in Palm Springs, I bought an entire dress suit that was owned by this singer called Keely Smith, and I wore it on Conan when I did stand up. And I loved that. I just love crap like that. Like, I love pop culture memorabilia and that kind of era of music.
But also not fetishizing it. Is that what you say? Because you know, you
could
buy that.
It and you
It's the ring. You're not putting it in a vault.
No way.
You're actually going to wear it every day.
Totally.
It's like I love that because these objects would be used now to just being hung up and in a kind of air container and looked after. And you're giving them new life.
You got to wear them out, you know. But no, I don't have the ring, so I would have heisted it. But you know. But no, I don't know. That was probably a really stupid choice. But
no, it's brilliant.
But one,
I love that choice, and it's in an auction house.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, also, can see this in a TV show. There's something quite cool about it.
Anybody can go and sit in an auction. They're free.
Yeah,
you can go and witness them, and they're like, it's very theatrical.
It really is, isn't it? And these guys go for the auctioneer. We went for honestly like 6 hours.
Yeah.
How?
The stamina.
How? The stamina.
Yeah.
I could not believe it. I was like, when are you having a break? Do you get a tea? Do you want a coffee? Are you going to go to the loo? Like, when are you going to the bathroom? It was astounding.
It all happens under the stand.
I was wondering why that table
there's
was so wide.
There's a toilet. There's everything. It all
I was
happens.
Wondering why that chair club. Flushed.
Anyway, the other question we ask every guest is, what is your favourite colour?
Oh my gosh. If it weren't for my mother beating it out of me, it would have been purple. I would have said purple.
She hates purple.
She hated purple as a kid.
My mum hates purple.
Why? Why do they hate purple?
It reminds her of death, I think.
Yeah, I don't know what my mum.
You're wearing
like,
purple today.
I know I'm wearing purple.
So you're representing.
I would say.
Colour.
Yeah, I would say though. I'd say green, to be honest, which is annoyingly her favorite color. But as I've grown older, I have come to like green. So, now fuck it, purple. Purple. And I know Mum's listening to this probably, so
shout it really loud.
Purple, Mum. Purple.
What is the best advice you've ever received when it comes to your art?
Or your creativity.
Your creativity, your craft.
Oh my gosh, advice. I'm usually the annoying person trying to give advice rather than take advice.
You can have your advice as well. We'll take
give that. Us advice.
No. I think I once had advice to soften my accent and I was like, I ignored that very quickly. Advice. I don't know. It's funny because I think I don't really tend to surround myself with like people who tend to like, you know, give me advice because I'm such an eye roller and I'd be like, how dare you? I think I live in a, I came up though in a, you know, group of comedians who I think were just inspiring, especially when I was younger, when I was about 15, I like met comedians like Josie Long and David O'Doherty and Maeve Higgins, who were like this era of quite cool mid-2000s, like people would describe them as like almost like whimsy. But like, I think particularly a person like Josie Long, who I am still friends with, she was so inspiring to me. She'd make zines in her shows and she was so generous with her time and her comedy. And I think teaching, like she was kind of an example of just being yourself on stage, being unashamed about that, and being enthusiastic about life and things is not something to be embarrassed by.
Never apologize for
completely
it.
And I think there is, and particularly in comedy, is like there is maybe nowadays maybe there's more of a pressure to be, to seem cool or to seem like purely because, like, you know, I mean, from a brand perspective of like, you know, what your vibe is, and to get people to see you or get people like to your shows. I think there was a less of a pressure when I was coming up doing comedy, and I think inauthenticity like just comes through so quickly in comedy. Mm. Like if you're doing something that you don't find funny, you don't believe
yeah.
in.
Yeah.
And so I think that's definitely advice I think I got from those people, not directly, but from watching them perform. Mm. And that was stuff that I definitely, you know, tried to take through to my stuff. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Just be yourselves, guys.
Be authentic.
Yeah. Being authentic.
And embrace being a nerd.
Completely. If you're authentically a nerd, you can't change it. And it's so embarrassing to try.
Nerds
so,
change the world and make it a better place.
This is so true. We wouldn't have penicillin or something. Oh, that was an
exactly.
accident anyway, to be honest. That wasn't nerdery. That was a total
accident. Yeah.
What a wonderful way to end this episode.
Yes. What's next for you?
What's next for me? I'm, who knows? I'm just pottering around. Honestly, I'm doing some writing. I'm doing more directing, which is fun. Yeah, a bit more. I mean, I haven't done stand-up for a while. I don't know. I have no idea. Just doing bits and bobs, really.
Do you like directing?
I do love directing.
Because you don't like taking advice, I imagine you do.
Yeah, yeah. I don't like taking any advice. I love directing. I would prefer it. I wanted to be a director before anything else when I was a kid. So it's kind of come full circle now. I like bossing people around.
What was it like directing Russell?
I didn't direct Russell.
Oh, you didn't?
You were on set.
I probably tried to direct, yeah. Me and Alice always trying to direct people. It was great. But then Russell did the thing where he in rehearsal he just did it perfectly and it was very intimidating.
Really?
Yeah, and we're like, in that way of like, why wouldn't we not shooting that? But then obviously you just did it again, and so we're like, oh that's acting.
He's an actor.
I know.
Yeah.
I like that's honestly like watching you. I was like, oh, I'm supposed to do that. In rehearsals, I barely know the lines. I'm like, yeah, I'll do it on the day, whatever. Because I think as a writer, you kind of try and get away with it in that sense. But I was inspired by your professional nature.
Well, for those who haven't seen it, Russell plays a really obnoxious film director himself in Starstruck. So please tune in to season two. And if you haven't seen season one, obviously see season one as well.
It's so funny.
We are so happy you came on the show.
Oh, I'm so happy you had me. Thank you so much for having me. It's such a delight to talk to you both.
Yeah. And
we're going to follow your Instagram, hopefully see all your dad's Pandora's box.
Yes.
And everyone should follow you anyway. You're at Rose Matafeo.
Mm-hmm.
Lovely.
Simple.
And then we'll be posting.
And you'll see loads of stories of Rob just going, I love Rose, daily on my Instagram.
Yes. You check your
so if you go to my Instagram, it's just like a fan account of Rose Matafeo.
Yeah,
I run her fan club.
Someone has to.
Go to @talkart on Instagram and Twitter and follow us, and we will see you very soon. Thank you very much.
We'll be back soon. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram @TalkArt, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at corient.com. That's corient.com. Corient.com.